If you would like to support You Are Not So Smart directly, just go ahead and contribute directly to the cause, making this podcast bigger and better. You can do that very easily by going to patreon.com/youarenotsosmart. Welcome to the You Are Not So Smart podcast, episode 66. Is to become one with it. Fulfillment is the knowledge of rebirth and of us. This life is nothing short of a blossoming metamorphosis of chronic consciousness. Reality has always been buzzing with dream weavers whose hopes are nurtured by joy. It can be difficult to know where to begin if you've never experienced a spark devoid of self. It can be difficult to grow. Although you may not realize it, you are perennial. As awe-inspiring and mind-expanding as these words may seem, I can't claim ownership. They were created by an artificial intelligence of sorts, a computer program written by Seb Pierce.
So my name is Seb Pierce. I don't know how I want to be identified. I'm a developer. I work with websites, that kind of thing. You can say I live in Melbourne because I'll be moving there in a few weeks.
Seb told me that as a teenager, he became fascinated with New Age thinkers, New Age writings, and New Age personalities.
When I was about 19 or so, I was kind of a self-help junkie.
But the more he learned about New Age ideas and New Age personalities, the more he read books by these people, and the more he connected with them and their online presences, the more he noticed something that unsettled him.
I noticed after being involved in that stuff for a while that there were a lot of things that they were saying that didn't really match up with what they were doing.
Public tantrums, egotistical behavior, flaunting of wealth and status, you know, people stuff. It all began to take a toll on Seb's belief and his trust in these supposedly enlightened individuals.
It all culminated in this debate that I was watching on YouTube one time. It was a debate, I can't remember where it was, but it was called, Does God Have a Future?
Does God Have a Future? Was a debate televised on ABC in which science communicators Sam Harris and Michael Shermer debated famous New Age figures Deepak Chopra and Jean Houston.
When questions were asked to Chopra and Houston, their answers were just kind of like, you know, the spiel that they would do on their book tours and stuff. That was just, it was like selling their product. Full of buzzwords. Yeah, they would throw out these words that they knew that other people didn't understand. But they sounded scientific, and so that kind of lended authority to them, I think.
Here's a sample of what Seb is talking about.
Science tells us that nature is a discontinuity, that it's an on-off phenomenon, that there are gaps between every two ons, where you find a field of possibilities, a field of pure potentiality. Science doesn't call it God, but what is God if not the immeasurable potential of all that was, all that is, and all that will be? Science also tells us that this is a field of non-locality, where everything is correlated with everything else.
Seb was so struck by what he heard as a nonsensical verbal smokescreen that he wondered if he could write a computer program that could replicate it. Basically, he took all the buzzwords he could think of that felt new, agey, and fed them into a program that was written to obey the rules of English sentence structure. And then he added code that would produce the sort of statements that use, as he explains on his blog, quote, language games and emotions that lure people into this stuff.
Yeah, and you notice the people who think that they do understand it, like their followers, even they don't understand it. Or to them, understanding it just means not disagreeing with it, I think.
Yeah. Because its purpose is to create an emotion, is to create a feeling.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so, yeah, the result is that it looks profound, but really all the important words in there are just randomly generated.
And it works really, really well. I'll click the randomize button right now, which, by the way, is labeled reionize electrons. And here's what I just got. Consciousness consists of expanding wave functions of quantum energy. Quantum means a flowering of the authentic. Today, science tells us that the essence of nature is chi. We grow, we are reborn. A machine did that. A machine wrote those words. And in a weird way, it's almost like this machine passes some strange version of the Turing test. And if you want to play with it, you can go to his website, sebpierce.com/bullshit, or you can just search for the New Age Bullshit Generator. So why does this feel at first glance so deep and so profound, when in reality it's just randomly generated nonsense?
Well, it's kind of like the mind automatically imputes meaning on a sentence so long as it, like, we have a kind of innate sense of syntactic structure. And there's, like, you know, very, very long ago, there's work on this by Noam Chomsky and a bunch of other people.
That's Gordon Pennycook. He's the lead author of a new scientific paper that explores different people's susceptibility to bullshit.
So my name is Gordon Pennycook. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Waterloo. I study reasoning and decision making, and I guess also bullshit.
Pennycook explained that just as there is evidence to suggest we have an overactive agency detection system in our brains that alerts us to the possibility that the creak in the basement might be a serial killer or that the rustling in the leaves might be a hungry panther, we may also have an overactive agency detection system that identifies properly constructed sentences as likely written by some agent, some human, for some good reason.
Right. So you wouldn't assume that I would be presenting you with a bunch of random words, obviously. We have a bias towards assuming that there's going to be something said in a sentence, which is kind of like the opposite of what you'd want it to be.
It's the opposite of what you would want it to be because, as Gordon explained, we tend to have this belief that we are always critical of just about everything. And in this case, that we're always alert to the fact that we might be, at any given moment, confronted with the alluring pull of bullshit. And because of that, our built-in bullshit detector stands vigilant at all times to incoming fluff and pseudo-profound statements designed to sweep us up. But that's just not true. It's wishful thinking.
We do the opposite. We just assume there's going to be something there, and we have to, like, always catch up, basically.
So if you have a human brain, then you are susceptible to bullshit. Everyone is. But some people are a bit more receptive than others, especially if that bullshit seems deep and profound at first glance. Pennycook and his team set out to understand what factors play into our varying degrees of receptivity. And one of the tests he used is called the CRT, the Cognitive Reflection Test. So here's a question from the test, and I want to see how you do. And remember, how you perform might reveal something about how vulnerable you are to bullshit artists of all stripes. So here's the question. If it takes 5 machines 5 minutes to make 5 widgets, how long would it take 100 machines to make 100 widgets? My name is David McCraney. This is the You Are Not So Smart podcast. And in this episode, we're exploring bullshit. The answer to the question I just asked about the widgets and the rest of our story with Pennycook and his exploration of our receptivity right after this break. I am a huge fan of the Great Courses. They are just the best advertiser you could ever hope for because they actually send me every course that I tell you about. So now I have this big collection of courses in my car, and I'm doing all this traveling, all these road trips, collecting interviews, and I have hours and hours of deep knowledge delivered by top professors and people who are extremely passionate about what they're presenting in a format that is professionally produced and follows in a series of ever-increasing and ever-deepening knowledge toward a total understanding of each topic. It's so cool. It's the best. You've got to check out the Great Courses. This one that I'm telling you about today is Behavioral Economics, When Psychology and Economics Collide by Scott Hutel, Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Duke University. I have right here in front of me. You may can hear that. That is the book that comes with the course. Can you believe that? A book. And it gives you an overview of everything that you hear on each of the episodes, not episodes really, of each of the courses. And if, for instance, this is so cool. I'm opening up just to a random page. This is Probability Weighting, Lecture number 6. Let's go to another page. Randomness and Patterns, Lecture 13. This is so cool. The Value of Experience, Lecture 15. It actually explains what is an experience, what happens when people undervalue and overvalue, what about memory, what about memory as identity, what about the research of Carter and Gilovich into the relative relativity of material and experiential purchases. Oh my God, you don't know what that is yet. But if you had this course, you would, and you can get it at 80% off. The Great Courses has lectures that cover more than 500 subjects. This is just one of them. You can get this course as a DVD, digital streaming, a download, or you can listen to it on an app. I cannot speak highly enough about the Great Courses. Such amazing material. What a great company. And here's the best thing of all. They're giving my listeners an offer that you can get today. You can get this course today at 80% off. Behavioral Economics, When Psychology and Economics Collide, 80% off the original price. And here's how you get it. It's available for a limited time only. It will go away. If you're listening to this several weeks down the line, I'm sorry, it's over. But to get it right now, go to thegreatcourses.com/smart. That's right. Today, 80% off. thegreatcourses.com/smart. And now we return to our program. So at this point, since we're talking about science and we're talking about bullshit, you might be wondering, what is the scientific definition of bullshit? Well, Gordon Pennycook and his team deferred to the lengthy definition put forth by philosopher Harry Frankfurt at Princeton. It contains lines like, the phenomenon itself is so vast and amorphous that no crisp and perspicuous analysis of its concept can avoid being Procrustean. It's actually fantastic, and it's free online. I'll have a link for you at the website. So, why would a world-renowned Princeton analytical philosopher write a lengthy essay attempting to define precisely what bullshit actually is? Well, here's Frankfurt's explanation from an interview he gave to the Princeton Press a few years ago.
It was largely because I think that respect for the truth and a concern for the truth, these are among the foundations of civilization.
And according to Frankfurt, a lack of concern for what bullshit is and how to avoid it is something that can really threaten a society. Frankfurt's 1986 essay was published as a tiny book in 2005, and in it, Frankfurt laid out exactly what bullshit is and what it is not.
And became a bestseller, actually. So we actually just took his definition, so we didn't have to do it ourselves.
And that definition is very clear on one thing. Bullshit is not the same as lying, though it may contain lies mixed with truths.
Well, it consists in a lack of concern for the difference between truth and falsity. The motivation of the bullshitter is not to say things that are true or even to say things that are false, but he's serving some other purpose. And the question of whether what he says is true or false is really irrelevant to his pursuit of that ambition.
Bullshit is something constructed without any concern for the truth. Okay, so that's different from lying. Lying is actually very concerned with the truth. It's only concerned with, you know, subverting it. But in order for someone to lie, they have to think they know what the truth is. For a bullshitter, it's irrelevant. It's just not a part of the goals of communication.
Frankfurt wrote, "It is impossible for someone to lie unless he thinks he knows the truth. Producing bullshit requires no such conviction." So the goal of the bullshitter, according to Frankfurt and Pennycook, is to impress rather than inform, to elevate one's status in the eyes of others without any concern for the accuracy or validity of the statements made toward that goal.
The bullshitter wants to convince you of something in the context of, you know, Twitter, to get retweets and likes and followers and stuff like that.
So if you want to study the psychology of people in the presence of bullshit, there is a hurdle you must first overcome, and that is the fact that bullshit comes in many flavors. I could have worded that better. So not flavors, let's say varieties. Bullshit comes in many varieties. And the kind of bullshitting that you do commonly and routinely with your friends, it's just too ambiguous. It's too lacking in hardcore vividness and too open to interpretation for scientific testing. So Pennycook and his team decided to focus on one specific kind of bullshit, pseudo-profound bullshit, which is why they turned to the program created by Seb Pierce, the one that can generate an infinite supply of randomly generated statements that seem profound on the surface, but are actually nonsense.
I mean, because bullshit has not been investigated psychologically, we wanted to find what might be like the most kind of extreme example. So the sentences, like I said, they're just random words put together, and you might be able to discern some sort of meaning if you tried hard, but there's no intended meaning. So it's as those things, if we can tell you that anything definitively is bullshit, those sentences are bullshit. So that's why we stuck with pseudo-profound. It's just basically, it implies that there's something profound when, you know, it's the complete opposite. There's nothing at all in the sentence.
With a tool in hand for creating pseudo-profound bullshit, Pennycook and his team set out to create a sort of scale of receptivity, a spectrum of personality traits and test scores and responses to other kinds of information, judgments in other realms, and so on, that together could be used to predict a person's ability to detect bullshit and determine one's propensity to view nonsensical pseudo-profound statements as being deep and meaningful. Now, you might be thinking that this is just another way to measure the relative stupidity of different individuals, but raw intelligence actually isn't as much of a factor as you might think when it comes to falling for woo-woo and conspiracy theories, the supernatural and cryptozoology and, well, just all the other forms of bullshit.
So in terms of intelligence, you can have like a lot of computational ability. You could be like a brilliant physicist, but if you're not willing to think in a kind of analytic way about problems when you come across them in your everyday life, then you won't, practically speaking, be very intelligent. Mm-hmm. So the thing about these problems or the bullshit we present to people is that they have the kind of appearance of meaning, which means in order to kind of realize that they're vacuous, you have to kind of stop and think about what the words actually mean in relation to each other.
So let's go back to that question from before the break. If it takes five machines 5 minutes to make five widgets, how long would it take 100 machines to make 100 widgets? This is one of the questions that Penny Cook's team asked of the research subjects, and it's part of a test that is used in psychology called the cognitive reflection test. So if you thought about this, what did you come up with? Well, if you have a normal human brain, the first thing that popped in your mind was probably 100 minutes. That's the first thing that pops in my mind. And it's an intuitive reaction, you see, to this pattern of X, 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 and Y, Y, Y. 555 makes you think 100, 100, and you just sort of want to plug in that last 100. And it appears in your mind without any conscious effort. It feels right because the human brain often confuses ease of thought with probability of accuracy. And by the way, that's called the availability heuristic, but we can talk about that another time. So if you think about this, if you don't trust your gut and you actually think about it, you can easily work out that 5 machines, 5 minutes, 5 widgets means that each machine is just making 1 widget every 5 minutes, which means if you had 10 machines, then every 5 minutes you get 10 widgets. And if you had 50 machines every 5 minutes, you would get 50 widgets. And that means that the answer to how long it would take 100 machines to make 100 widgets is 5 minutes, not 100 minutes. But you would have to not trust your gut to get to that answer. All the questions on the cognitive reflection test are like this, and that's why Gordon and his team used it as a way of establishing just how analytical his subjects were before he presented them with the statements from the random generator.
Basically, they're just kind of math problems that have an intuitive response that's incorrect. So to get the correct answer, you have to question your initial intuition on the problem, which feels as though it's right, and think more about the problem. And, you know, there's also... It also is a sort of measure of cognitive ability because you have to be able to do the math. But the thing that's interesting with the problems is that the math is actually relatively simple.
The scientists also tested the subjects' verbal abilities, their need for cognition, their numeracy skills, their verbal intelligence, and several other traits, including something called ontological confusion.
So basically, an ontological confusion is a confusion of any two ontological categories. So one example would be extrasensory perception. You know, that's I can control people's behavior with my thoughts, or I have access to their thoughts via my thoughts or something like that. I'm mistaking the physical for the mental. So those are two ontological categories. And it's kind of something that underlies most, or I guess all supernatural beliefs. It's kind of like every supernatural belief there's two categories that are being conflated, I guess. So the way that we kind of measure it, you give people things like the house has memories, and they rate how literal or metaphorical it is.
So participants would rate from a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being this is a fully metaphorical statement and 5 being this is a fully literal statement. Things like friends are the salt of life, or Wayne Gretzky was a hockey player, or a rock lives for a long time. And after testing many, many different people, on all these different scales of personality and scales of cognitive ability, a spectrum started to emerge. And on one side, you had people who were reflective thinkers, who engaged in what you would call metacognition. They thought about their own thoughts a lot. And on the other end of the spectrum, you had people who just sort of went with it, who didn't really think too much about how they thought about stuff that they were thinking about.
The kind of grouping of variables was a rerun of prior studies. So we knew that people that are more analytical and more intelligent tend to be less religious, and they aren't as ontologically confused, or they have, you know, and they have lower paranormal beliefs and stuff like that. So it was kind of like, we just wanted to get the same, they all tell the same sort of story, in the sense that people that are more skeptical and they do better on the kind of reasoning problems are more skeptical about things like religious beliefs, and they'll be more skeptical about the bullshit we present them.
So, you know, a question comes up here, and that is for me, and that is, so these people who tend to be more reflective thinkers and tend to be less prone to jumping into intuitive estimations of the answers to things, and you know, they tend to be more likely to think about their own thinking, less ontologically confused, all of that stuff. Does that seem to be something that a person develops as a skill, or does that seem to be something that is, they... I guess I'm asking, is that more of a nature-nurture thing, or is that are we default bad at this stuff and we learn to be not bad at it, or do we learn to be bad and learn to be good?
Almost certainly both. But there's no real good answers to that, because there isn't enough research on it. So we don't really know what the kind of, for example, the genetic basis of thinking dispositions and stuff like that are. There's work on genetic base of intelligence, and there's work on, you know, genetic base of religious belief and all that stuff. But because these are all kind of high level cognitive categories, it gets very complicated to get the collection of them. And then there's always the rules are violated more often than they are not, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah.
Because people that are more analytical are less religious, for example. But if I was using that to predict, if I just took religious belief by itself and I use that to predict how smart people are, I wouldn't be doing very well, right?
Right. See,
it's not that strong of a correlation, right?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because, you know, there's a tendency to think this is just the kind of person. There's a kind of person that's going to end up being very superstitious, and there's a kind of person that's going to end up being very religious, and a kind of person who's going to be very prone to conspiratorial thinking and that kind of stuff. And then there's another way of looking at it, which is thinking that, well, these are thinking habits. These are tendencies of, these are the ways that you have learned to make sense of the world. And so that it's much more. And so I'm just wondering from your perspective, and you can, I understand this is going to be speculative, but I'm wondering if it's like, do you over time get worse at reflective thinking because of the habits that you're building up, and versus over time you get better at reflective thinking because of other habits that you build up? What do you think?
And thinking disposition, at least in my view, but like I said, I don't have any really good evidence for this, but it seems to be more of a learned tendency to me.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's probably something that's picked up more in adolescence, though, you know what I mean? And especially, I mean, we had undergrad students, and then we also had an older sample with Americans, but they're not appreciably old. And I'm pretty sure that we kind of pick up certain tendencies when we, as we learn to first think, and then they modify slightly depending on a bunch of different factors that I have no idea about. But we kind of, most of the stuff happens in adolescence, I think.
Right. Like, you know, almost all like Nobel Prize winners have average intelligence. And, you know, most of the people who accomplish great things and are people who aren't super geniuses. They're just people who work really hard, and they have good self-control and work ethic and so on and so forth. And there's a tendency to think that people are smart or stupid. And, And even if we were to judge people that way, it doesn't seem to matter all that much. And this research in particular made me feel like this is a lot. This is more about a style of thinking that I would suspect is culturally produced, and, you know, it is learned. You learn to think in a certain way. And it's almost the story of science itself, is that we had to learn how to think in a certain way. And before we did that, you know, we were, you know, burning witches. And then after that, and then we went to the moon, you know? So it was a way of thinking. I would say the kind of people that went to the moon, in my mind, were equally intelligent to the kind of people who were burning witches. It was just a different way of thinking about the world.
I mean, it's not as if, our brains are different, like, you know, totally rewired compared to the, you know, the man of the Middle Ages, right? So I think you're onto something for sure. And that's the way I've been thinking about it since I've been doing this work for sure.
Pennycook told me that his study into what sort of people are most receptive to nonsense masquerading in deep, intellectually nutritious profundity was meant to establish the groundwork for future study. It was meant to be a way to begin working on understanding this aspect of belief itself. And belief, strange as this may sound, isn't all that well understood, scientifically speaking. So he urged me to remind you that this is just one paper at the beginning of a long investigation. In other words, don't fall for that trap in science journalism that leads to headlines like, "Study finds people who fall for nonsense, inspirational quotes, are less intelligent," which is a real headline that came out right after he published his research. Which is silly, because the very person who created the program that Pennycook's team used to measure whether or not people were susceptible to bullshit was someone who used to be susceptible to bullshit. So, I mean, the reason he made the program at all was because he once was a person who was really, really, really into that sort of language and that sort of book and that sort of talk, and he became fascinated with how it actually worked and what was behind it. So what did Pennycook and his team find? What was the result of all this work? Well, what they discovered was that with the random sentences generated from computer programs, a little more than a quarter of the people they studied rated those sentences as being actually, truly profound. And subjects were also tested to see how well they did on cognitive reflection, verbal skills, lots of other stuff, how they rated in overall religious beliefs, ontological confusion, which was the fancy way of saying that they checked to see if they believed in the supernatural, things like ESP and ghosts. And so researchers found this big correlation that people who are most likely to consider these random nonsensical phrases being deep and meaningful were also the people who were the most religious, held the deepest belief in the supernatural, and scored the lowest on the cognitive reflection and verbal intelligence tests. Just to be sure, subjects were also presented with statements that were just, you know, factual. Like, most people enjoy some kind of music. And statements counter to those that were straightforward but widely considered to actually be profound, like, a river cuts through a rock, not because of its strength, but because of its persistence. And they found that most people correctly identified the mundane statements as being mundane and the profound statements as being profound. So what this says, what it seems to be showing us, is that most people can tell the difference between truly profound statements and truly mundane statements. But when it comes to bullshit, we each fall somewhere along a spectrum. And on one end sits people who are intuitive thinkers, who, when confronted with just the right amount of vagueness and implied deepness, will, as neurologist Stephen Novella wrote in commenting on this research, quote, reflect their own belief onto the statements, end quote. It's somewhat similar to how we all kind of make up the meaning of certain ambiguous songs or poems or David Lynch movies, except in the case of bullshit, there's usually someone benefiting from this kind of behavior and often betting on it. So, what is the big takeaway? As we come in for a landing, as we sum this all up, I thought it would be great to bring in someone I deeply respect, psychologist Barbara Drescher, and ask her what she thought about the research and how we should digest it.
So what they found is that people that are lower in cognitive ability are more prone to what they call ontological confusions and conspiratorial ideation, and they're more likely to hold religious and paranormal beliefs, and they're more likely to endorse complementary and alternative medicine. But that those people who are more receptive, they're less reflective. But those are just correlations, and they're just correlations to ratings of profundity. So how profound they're rating these things. But it's about cognitive, analytical cognitive style. So, you know, how reflective people are. But it's not so black and white as it's not so simple as saying, well, smart people don't fall for it. Yeah, they do.
You know? Obviously so.
They obviously do. There's no sensitivity, there's no association. This is what I found the most interesting of their findings. There's no association between bullshit sensitivity and conspiratorial ideation or the acceptance of complementary and alternative medicine. Mm-hmm. These are very much in line. These findings are very much in line with some of the research that looks at personality factors and finds that people who believe in the paranormal, people who believe in people who are religious, people who believe in ghosts, people who believe in psychic phenomenon are somewhat different in their psychological makeup or in their personality makeup than people who believe in, say, cryptozoology, conspiracies, alternative medicine, and things like that. And if you think about it, it makes sense. One is about the supernatural, and the other is really about how we evaluate evidence and information that's real, mm-hmm. and how we integrate that and make sense of it. And so these are completely different types of beliefs, or they stem from different types of processes. So it would make sense that people are different. And so you get the people, what this tells me is that people who believe in ghosts and paranormal, you know, supernatural phenomena, on average, or you know, there's a loose correlation, or it's, some of these are actually pretty high correlations, so I should qualify that, with the way that they separate regular statements from things that sound profound.
Yeah.
And that may be a desire to see the world as being more meaningful and more profound than people like me want to see the world.
It's really, really great that to if nothing else, see that there's I think it's very easy to lump in conspiracy theorists and people who are, you know, homeopaths and all that kind of stuff with people who believe in ghosts or, you know, unicorns or whatever. It's very easy to lump it all together as, you know, that big umbrella of woo being but it's as with everything, once you really dig in, you're like, oh no, this is very nuanced and not everybody's the same. And there's more, it's more complicated than that. That was just like you're saying, that was a very interesting thing that came out of this research. And I understand, you know, there's one study and all this stuff that goes along with that. But, you know, there was a lot in here about metacognitive beard stroking and you know, and how, like, you know, how that correlates. And it seems like they identify there's a spectrum of receptivity, but it's more of the spectrum is not a spectrum of smart and stupid.
No, not at all. It's more of a spiritualness, I would think.
Yeah.
That's the way I think about it. I think of profoundness as being kind of, you know, this spiritual feeling or view of the world or view the way you want to view the world anyway. And it would make sense that it would correlate with those things.
Cause like, my thought on this is like, okay, people who are really into the pyramids, some people are into the pyramids because they think they have energies and powers that, like, you know, transcend dimensions or something. And then other people are really into the pyramids because maybe aliens built them and there's a conspiracy that's covering it all up. And it seems like it just makes, that's one of those things you can be like, yeah, people who believe pyramid stuff are wacky, but there's two different kinds of, you know, belief. There's two different kinds of thinking.
Yeah. They're very different. And the way that people analyze the information is very different. You know, you get stuff that's more vague or confirmation, you know, of interpreting input, sensory input, you know, is one way.
Yeah.
And the other is, I don't know, it's very numbers based, in my opinion. It feels very numbers based and more cognitive but they all think they're being smart. But the people who believe in conspiracies and, aliens and things like that think they're being academically smart.
Yeah, yeah. They think they're just
science actually.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And the other ones are saying, "Screw the science."
Yeah, yeah. What does science know? Science, every 5 years they say something else is bad for you. You can find Barbara Drescher at icbseverywhere.com, and that's ICBS, the actual letters. Gordon Pennycook is at the University of Waterloo and can be found by searching their website at uwaterloo.ca. Harry Frankfurt's book, On Bullshit, is available pretty much wherever books are sold, and the New Age Bullshit Generator can be found at Seb Pierce's website, sebpierce.com. Links to all of that will be in the show notes for this episode at youarenotsosmart.com. Up next, a cookie, and then the end credits.
what starts with the letter C? Cookie starts with C. Let's think of other things that starts with C. Who cares about other things? C is for cookie. That's good enough for me.
On each episode of the You Are Not So Smart podcast, I eat a cookie baked from a recipe sent in by a listener or a reader of the books or a reader of whatever else they can find that has You Are Not So Smart written next to it. And in this episode, what we're going to eat is just one of the greatest cookies. It came out of nowhere. It was one of the most recent emails that we had received, and I just thought, this looks so good, we have to shoot it all the way up to the top of the queue. It comes from Nick Dahlstrom, and they're called Lemon Ricotta Cookies with Lemon Glaze. Ugh, lemon. Look, if you want to send in a cookie recipe, send it to david@youarenotsosmart.com. If we cook, bake, eat, and talk about your cookie, you will get a signed copy of the You Are Not So Smart book. Okay, so Nick says, this cookie is a cookie that his mom bakes around the holidays. He says, I just can't get enough of them. It blows my mind. And it's also not only just made from lemons, it's made from ricotta cheese. He says that just blows his mind how that could be possible. I also can't believe it's possible. And I watched it being made. Amanda made these this morning and they smelled so good. I cannot wait to put this in my mouth. I'm not sure. He writes, I'm not sure where my mom got this recipe. She's always trying new recipes, but this has by far become my favorite. I hope you enjoy. So if you want this recipe, just go to youarenotsosmart.com. You will see the recipes for cookies listed above all the podcast episodes, along with transcripts and all the other stuff. And you will be able to find the recipe to this. It's flour and baking powder and salt and butter and sugar and eggs and ricotta cheese, lemon juice, and zested lemons. You mix it together. What happens is you make this glaze separate from the cookie. You bake the cookie, put the glaze on it, and it is fantastic. There's lemon juice, lemon zest. It's also good. Here we go. Let's try it. Looking forward to this. Let's see what happens.
So much lemon.
Oh man. This is a serious cookie. This cookie introduces itself by holding up one of those unfolding IDs with a badge in it. And this cookie says, my name is Agent Cookie Cookington with the Federal Cookie Investigation Unit. I'd just like to ask you a few questions about your cookie consumption. And I am intimidated. I say, what is this all about? And it goes, I'll be asking the questions here, sir. Have you been eating croissants made in a factory or anything by Little Debbie in the last few months? You shouldn't have, because this is something you can make yourself. This is the kind of cookie that gets its shoes. This is the kind of cookie that gets its shoes shined in the airport with 0 second thoughts. Like, it just goes right up and just does it. You know, it doesn't think, should I do this? This is weird. Is this a thing that people should be doing in the 21st century? It just needs shiny shoes. It reads the newspapers in other languages, so it has something to say about the current events when it meets with the ambassador of Tunisia and has to have shiny shoes for the meeting. Oh, man. And the lemonness of this cookie. You know how they say if you, like, shrink the earth down to the size of a pea, it would, like, become a tiny black hole? This cookie is so lemony. I imagine its pure, concentrated lemonness is like what would happen if you shrunk all the lemons on Earth down to the point where they made a black hole. The flavor of this cookie, it seems like what that proto-singularity would taste like right before it crossed the point of no return. Oh, one more bite. I'm sorry, audience.
Oh. Lemon!
That is good. Nick Dahlstrom, tell your mom, I love you. Lemon ricotta cookies with lemon glaze. A serious, shiny-shoed cookie that you need to make. Oh, so great. I'm making these as much as possible in the future. Thank you, Nick. A book is headed your way.
Itchy, me,
That is it for this episode of the You're Not So Smart podcast. This was an experimental episode for me. Usually there is a self-delusion news segment, and I thought it might be neat to just blow one of those segments all the way up into a full episode, and it was neat. I will get better at it. It was definitely experimental. If you want more episodes like this one, you want more shows like this one, go to boingboing.net. And if you want all of the back catalog of the show, go to youarenotsosmart.com. You also find show notes for every single episode. This music is Banjo Apocalypse. The opening music is Clash by Caravan Palace. The interstitial music is by Drew Garraway. All the other music I bought using money that was raised by patrons, sent in by patrons on Patreon, and you can participate in that. You can go to patreon.com/youarenotsosmart to help make this show better. Thank you so much.